Welcome to the People in the Red Vest, a podcast of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, the IFRC. In each episode, we feature inspiring, surprising, and thought-provoking conversations with people who dedicate their lives to helping others. In this episode, Mahbub Malim knows what it's like to be hungry. He grew up in eastern Kenya at a time when drought and post-colonial conflicts forced many from their land and their livelihoods. I'm your host, Alexandra Sasha Gorishek, and in this episode, I speak with Mahbub Malim about the severe food insecurity impacting multiple countries across Africa. He now serves as Special Advisor on Hunger to IFRC.
There was hunger all over. There was those problems all over. And that is the year I was going to high school. And I was going to like 300 kilometers away out of Garissa. My town is called Garissa. And the transportation for us at the time were 30, 40 tonne lorries carrying relief food. And you lie flat on bags of maize and bags of rice that was carrying relief food. And the food would be distributed on the way. And you get the ride out of it. So I saw it firsthand, and I saw people who became very, very thin, and children who are obviously malnourished. The experience was impacted in my head. So I know about it very, very well.
Ambassador Mahbub Malim, welcome to the People in the Red Vest.
Thank you so much.
At this point, it's over 140 million people across several countries in Africa that are facing a severe food security crisis. Why has it become so bad in comparison to previous years?
It's because of the trends of events over a long period of time. The cyclic period between various climate-related issues over time has become less and less, as opposed to how it was 40, 50 years ago. The first time I remember myself, I had an experience on a drought, was in 1970. The next drought was in 1980, that is 10 years, and then the next was in 1990. And then between 90 and 2000, the span was 5 years. 90 and now, the span is basically a year and a half or 2 years, so it's perennial. So are floods, so are disease epidemics, pest infestation. So you somehow because of the global changes of events, and mainly these days related to climate change, things have become much more nearer to each other, and therefore recovery is a problem, linkage with development is a problem. Then of course, together with that is some of our general, policies in the continent, some degree of bad politics. A combination of the entire mesh of events that has made economic growth a bit difficult, and therefore it's natural that then not more time has been spent on systemic and continuous financing and concentration on building recovery for the communities.
Food insecurity is also something very close to you. As you said, you've experienced it over different decades. You've actually seen hunger in your own life, in your childhood. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, yes, but I grew up in a pastoralist setting where basically the stable food for families, milk and meat. Therefore, when the climatic condition is such that milk production is either lessened or not there at all, and when the body conditions for the animals that provide meat is so bad and so emaciated, to the extent that there's no reason to slaughter an animal or you can't even sell it, and then it means basically families sit around and with no diet for the day, for example. So this is the kind of society I come from. The one that I personally experienced was what I mentioned, 1970, when there was this, for the first time, one of the worst droughts at that time. And our governments at that time were also pretty much new governments all over. And Kenyan government at that time was basically, we got the independence in the end of 63, so barely 7 years old, and we're still getting our policies together and issues like those. And then there was also there was a political issue, and the part of the country that I come from was trying to secede and join Somalia at the time. There was a referendum to join Somalia, and then the new Kenyan government refused. And therefore, there were young men from our side who were in the other side of the border being trained and provided with ammunition to come and fight the Kenyan government in a bid to secede that region in Somalia. So this is a very bad time. So drought hit, government is new, there is war that we're just recovering from. The conditions are not favorable for anybody, either to business or even to herd animals, because of the insecurity and because of the presence of military and the militia from that side at that time that were called shifter. And therefore, there was hunger all over. There was those problems all over. And that is the year I was going to high school. And I was going to like 300 kilometers away out of Garissa. My town is called Garissa, to a county called Wajir. And the transportation for us at the time were 30, 40 tonner lorries carrying relief food. So that's for a lift from a driver. You see a young person who would indicate, go up the lorry, and you lie flat on bags of maize and bags of rice that was carrying relief food. And the food would be distributed on the way, and you'd get the ride out of it. So I saw it firsthand, and I saw a lot of emaciated people. I saw people in feeding camps, and I saw people who became very, very thin, and children who are obviously malnourished. Fortunately, I was going to high school, and therefore, at least we were in a boarding school, and we had some little food to eat at the time, but then the experience was impacted in my head. So I know about it very, very well.
So you actually really know what hunger means and what's behind it. So let's talk about the causes of this current food insecurity. Food prices, for example, are soaring and have been for some time. Why is this? And what does it mean for an average family in some of the affected countries?
So some of the reasons we've already mentioned, like the successive weather-related phenomena that then disables people from living their life ordinarily. For example, we'll talk about that for a minute. A phenomenon like drought. Out of all the factors that that trigger emergencies in our region, 83% of it is just weather-related. And out of that 83%, probably 50-60% is mainly drought. And that's one of the biggest, one of the worst phenomena that totally disempowers people. It affects the environment. So all of a sudden, the environmental condition changes. The vegetation cover, which provides food for the herd, for the livestock, that is mainly the mainstay of the people in most of the drought-affected areas, is eroded. Some of the animals that are tall animals, like the camels, for example, which is one of the most stable animals for livelihood food base in the pastoral communities, then can't get browse. Browse is the leaves outside trees where so that's also depleted. The water bodies start drying up, and therefore all of a sudden the environment is affected very badly. And then on the food security aspect for the livestock farmer, then his animal's body condition is emaciated. There is no milk. He can't sell it. The markets are depressed. For the crop agricultural farmer, then rains have failed, so crop production is not enhanced, and therefore not much is available. And therefore, this causes a collapse in the rural economy. People are not salary earners like me and you, for example. They get their money from the sales of the livestock or sale of crops, and therefore there's no money in people's pockets and they can't access food. Those who try to sell animals or sell more animals to access a 90-kilogram bag of maize, those who have the maize, can't produce the maize and therefore don't even have it. Shortage is caused. So those are the general issues. But of late also, there has been the COVID-19 effects. That has been a serious hit on us because of the shutdown, because of business collapses, all small businesses collapsed, livestock markets closed, crop production was affected because of obvious reasons of not getting inputs on timely matter. So that really also, people got sick, a lot of people died. So many a house or lost people, and people kept mourning and stuff like that. That threw people into disarray. And also the Russian war, the Russian-Ukraine war, has also not done well for us, because there's been a lot of food imports for that part of the world. So this has costed us to have shortages of mainly grains, wheat and rice. And then it has also affected the dollar and the currency imbalance. The dollar in Kenyan shilling, I think, has gone up by about 100 shillings more. So you need much more Kenyan shillings now to acquire a dollar. So it's a big problem for everybody. So that has really, so that kind of combination of effects has had a serious effect on people's livelihood building capacity. But also not to forget, these issues also have a way of impacting conflicts among communities. So poor communities start hating each other, start fighting, because development is depressed. Not much development is taking place, particularly during these seasons when people are hungry. Government budgets and efforts, international community efforts, is geared towards feeding people as being geared towards development. I remember a famous quotation from my reading that Pope Paul VI, who was a former head of the Catholic Church, said that development is another word for peace. So lack of development means lack of peace. Lack of peace means conflict. Conflict means people not living well together. And therefore, then the equation changes. You need peace building and mediation efforts all of a sudden. Then you need a whole bunch of interventions as a result of trigger by climate change. And through climate change, food insecurity and hunger, really.
Yeah, it sounds like a vicious circle. It really does. And that's a wonderful quote that I remember as well. So the IFRC has issued an emergency appeal for donations to help address the situation in 15 countries. Beyond the money that we, of course, hope to raise, what are the strategies embedded in that appeal that will help the most affected communities? And how will we make sure that these strategies will actually be effective?
The most immediate strategy is a strategy of offering cash payment to people, where you pay cash for people to acquire their basic needs. This, I remember, having worked in the humanitarian space for a long time, is something we have been trying to make a case for a very long time. There's a time when that was not possible. There's even a time when we were convincing the UN World Food Program to buy food locally, you know. And of course, the quantities that we were able to sell to them was not anywhere. It was just a fraction, very, very small fraction. However, we're saying just buy the small fraction so that people can have cash in their pocket. So finally now, through IFRC appeal and through many years of, probably policy formulation and changes, we're able now to say we are going to give people cash. And I know IFRC, the African region, has had cash programs for people. And this has changed people's lives because of the immediate impact of what cash can do to people. The other strategy that is embedded here is provision of water. And here, and my background is engineering, and some of the last engineering projects that I have undertaken were water projects, small scale structures that provide that hold water during the rainy seasons, and that can provide communities with water supplies for their need. And with water supplies, of course, the better sanitation and people's health is improved. Equally important is also the area where the strategy talks about food production, particularly looking at the aspects of drought-tolerant crops, enhancement of human community supplies, and community sensitization is also important. And aspect related to it is also aspect of afforestation, where then the environmental conditions are improved, and therefore this acts as a basis for positive contribution to post-hunger crisis period, so that there's a nexus between end of the hunger crisis to long-term development and long-term resilience development.
Let's talk a little more about your own background in working to address issues such as chronic hunger that we're talking about. One of your first interactions with the humanitarian, but also development sector, as you say, they're closely connected, was when as a young man, you would get a ride to remote areas on the food convoys that were bringing food supplies from Garissa to remote communities back in the early 1970s. What did you think of all that at the time? What did you learn? And did you have any idea at the time that responding to food insecurity would become a lifelong endeavor for you?
Well, I was 13. When I went to Form 1, I was 13. And really, I wouldn't think about the fact that it may be a long-term issue for me. But I'm sure psychologists would be able to explain this better. It went into my head. So it's something that I wouldn't think about it as a 30-year-old. But that then gradually, as I grew up and I started getting into the work-life environment, then it is something that I remember continuously and constantly. That also impacts on my judgment all the time. So I see the difficulties in my head all the time. But because, as I said, I could tell at that time, even as a 13-year-old, that this is a bit dehumanizing. I just knew that we cannot feed people through things that we carry, that these things that come from some place that is loaded on a lorry, that then is offloaded someplace, and then people queue up, because I used to see the queues for food. I knew that this is not right. I just could tell that this is not right and this is not sustainable. And there was some kind of dislike in my mind, even at that time. So as I grew up and I went into working life, everything that I did, I could do from the background of making a contribution to things that would probably make it less and less possible for people to go through that kind of experience, or to help them build their capacity. If ever they come through that kind of lifeline, then they can be in a better status than those who were being fed in the 1970s, for example. So it was really a very humbling experience. So as I talk to somebody now, even today at my age, I would think differently from probably people who may not have had that kind of experience.
From the beginning of your career, as you just started explaining, you've worked at the community level to address the issues of poverty, hunger, and local development. Can you tell us about how your career started, your first job? What were the key lessons that stuck with you all your life?
Well, some of the key lessons that stuck with me in my life are the following. One, I developed respect for systems, and you will never attend a meeting that I'm participating, including one that I was in yesterday, where I have not talked about systems, where I have not talked about the need to develop systems that work, that outlive people. Because I remember when I first left high school, it was in 1975, and I was in Garissa, the communication was nowhere. So I took a paper and I wrote an application for an employment letter to the Minister of Water. And I put that application letter in an envelope and I closed it and I put a stamp on it. Within 2 weeks, I got a reply offering me my first job in the Ministry of Water in Kenya. Now, because in our government at that time, we had a system that worked. I'm not insulting the government now. I'm not saying there's no system that works. So that is something that I've strived to uphold in my working life, to make sure that wherever I am, I develop systems that work and that is inclusive and that is equitable to people. That's very important in my life. I'm very emotional about it. The other thing that impacted also in my life is the decision-making process that you realize that you make decisions for more people. So if you are at the national level in Kenya or anywhere else, then you make decisions for 50 million people. So it's not about you. It's not about your emotions at that time. It's not about what you feel. It's not about the office you sit. It's about that decision. And therefore, that decision better be a balanced decision, good decision for the common good for everybody. And that also can outlive you and can be remembered as a legacy for you. So the decisions I made in my working life, and thanks to God, I've been in a management position all my life, has been such decisions. So I have people who find me on the streets, in Nairobi, in Addis Ababa, in Khartoum, in everywhere I go, and who shake my hands and say, you know, I worked with you, and this is what we did together. And that makes me feel very good, and that's something that I really would want to uphold.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation that there's a cyclical nature to issues of drought and hunger. That is true for Africa and for many other parts of the world. And people often wonder, why can't we solve these problems, get at the causes, instead of dealing with the aftermath every few years? In your opinion, why is that? What can we do to start developing more sustainable solutions?
Okay, well, if I seem simplistic, then I apologize. Well, I really think that the answer is not as complicated as the question. There are things that need to happen in day-to-day operations, in relief and in development. And one of those things is coordination. You know the volumes and tons of money that is spent globally on humanitarian issues day in, day out, and throughout. For whatever the reason, whatever the cause of the humanitarian issue is. So can you just imagine if in every place where this has occurred, there is better coordination among the people and the groups who do this, if they start together willingly and honestly, and people declared what they had, what they can do, and people accepted to be in a common coordination mechanism. Can you just imagine the synergy that only that will bring? That is a very, very big failure in international humanitarian support mechanism. So we need to improve that. The other thing we need to improve is information. You'll be surprised how long it takes for people with a pass to be able to open their pass and release funds because they don't trust the information that they're getting. So can you just imagine if we had a tailor-made, properly done information system where rapid assessments are done together, actors work together, and the information that is produced is acceptable to donors, to governments, to communities. Can you just imagine how the time it will cut for those who are willing to help, to immediately help, as opposed to writing volumes and volumes of paperwork from different places in the world, from New York, from Geneva, from Nairobi, from God knows where, African Union. By the time you went through those, trying to get an information of even the number of people affected only, as simple as that, how long that takes, as opposed to if the answer was correct from day one. So can we improve information? And associated with this also, can we also improve response, methodology of response, timeliness of response, appropriateness of response? I've seen in my working life in the relief operation where in pastoral communities which needed water and needed, say, veterinary medication for their dying animals, planting seeds being offloaded from lorries. A lot is offloading planting seeds in a place where the temperature is nearly 50 degrees and animals are dying. So if you came with tetracycline for the camels that day, you'd be much more applauded and appreciated than bringing seeds for planting at that time. Now, seeds for planting were required elsewhere. So appropriateness and timeliness. And finally, the issue of policy. We have bits and pieces of policies scattered all of our shelters in our reading rooms and our offices. If we have policies that have come as a result of multi-stakeholder inclusion and stuff, and they mean something because the operational policies, and they can be put off the shelf to kind of be used as and long-term strategies are developed that then is respected again by everybody. Policy that's acceptable and owned by all of us. So those who come, for example, wherever it is, then just go by it, other than trying to question it, other than having developing another bit and piece of a policy, for example. It's very hard, of course. It's easier said than done. But those are the issues that require to be streamlined for us to be able to do a long-term intervention seamlessly and over a period of time.
One of the things that you mentioned is trust in the information that is provided to partners. As we've seen in the last several years, trust in institutions is actually decreasing. How do we address that as an organization that works with national societies in the country context and the national context? And how do we make sure that the information we provide is actually accurate and reliable?
Yes. Well, first of all, and I'm not trying to blow the trumpet for IFRC or the movement, for example. The truth of the matter is nobody in the world, in the areas that the movement is present, that has much more ground truth information than the movement. No doubt about it. If you are watching television anywhere, and I've experienced this, the first group of persons you see on the if there is a tanker that has crashed, the first people you see on site are people who are in the gowns, kind of gowns I'm in now. You see this kind of gown, and I think we've been very generous also as a movement to provide this. So we tell Jagan now, call upon Jagan to provide more of this free for more people, because this is very, very important. This is our sign. So you see those people, you initially see one person or two people, then you see more of them. In a very short time, in a couple of hours, you see more of them. Now, the information those people have is the most ground truth information. So it is a tragedy for us that we are that kind of people who are present there, who have the information. But so the weakness is that how do we then get that information, through the information provision system, and get it to the right places and get it owned by everybody? I'm a witness to other agencies quoting information from the field provided by the movement volunteers, and they don't acknowledge the source of the information, for example. So the answer to your question would be because we already have the information, then that sensitizing our national societies, sensitizing our governments, and try to use the models that have worked in Kenya, for example, so that the movement's representatives are in mainstream decision-making processes, and they're armed with that information. And also the governments to be sensitized so that the advantage point of the movement is also recognized and therefore supported. So others who would be in the room and who probably would claim to be information agencies or so would also take this information seriously, because at the end of the day, they do know this is information that is credible and it's for the ground, for example. And of course, when that is done, when government and the movement is together, it will be much more easier to get others on board. And at that local level, to have actors at that local level believe that information.
If I may turn now to climate change specifically, it's clearly a major factor in the issues that we've been talking about. Clearly, Africa is greatly affected by climate change. Yet at the same time, it's possibly the most neglected continent or region when it comes to the climate adaptation agenda, and even access to finance mechanisms for adaptation. What's your take on that?
Well, the question is not anymore whether globally we're being affected by climate change. I know this argument has been on for a long time. There were international groups who would question that, but that I think we're finally past that. So we do know that things are not the same. The basic answer is that things are not the same, and they're not the same because of climate change. I mean, the places that were hotter than they used to be are much more cooler. Places that were cooler are much higher. There's a lot of higher rainfalls, less rainfalls. All those are explainable in terms of what's happening. But the key thing here is to, particularly from the African continent, is to look at because in this continent there are more people who are enduring conflicts, fragility, and complex emergencies. For example, to really understand how much of those. Because most of those are basically as a result of climate change. So then the question would be then what can be done? And what can be done is, making a case to the global community and look at what they call the climate financing. Right now, only 2%, I'm told, of the climate financing funding that really percolates from the developing countries to the from the highly developed countries to developing countries, for example. So, what the international community, in their own generosity and wisdom, put together as a mechanism to ameliorate problems in climate change, should be seen to be addressing areas that are mostly in need. And I just mentioned about areas that are grappling with fragility and conflict and complex emergencies. So the financing then is obvious where it should go, for example. So the fact that less and less of those is going to, of that financing is going to a place of higher need itself is something that requires to be interrogated. Secondly, then the whole policies that govern climate change issues should be policies that then have started from the grassroots, should be policies that have been done in a manner that is multi-sectoral in nature, that has started from the lowest level of humanity, and that has found its way into the decision-making tables at a higher level, at the global front, for example. So that then whatever outcome that comes, or support that comes as a result of that policy, is appropriate. And this, I think, is the advocacy in that direction. The direction of policy formulation is very important. And of course, the whole aspect of locally led climate action adaptation is very important. So let's not belittle small things. The world has begun small. Everybody has begun small. We all began as children, even ourselves, at our personal levels. So that's where the strength is. That's where strength. That strength, in my view, can be led by FRC. And that's why FRC should have a strategy where it continuously reassesses how it does business and should venture into non-conventional areas of operation where they are seen in the lead or advocating for grassroots-led actions and plans and adaptation.
We're recording this interview in late August, so just before the Africa Climate Week and then the Pan-African Conference. But the podcast will be released after those events. What do you hope for those two meetings to achieve?
I think the PAC is a very important gathering. We will have an opportunity to meet. We'll have an opportunity to interrogate each other. We'll have an opportunity to learn from each other. So it's a learning experience where representation from the region at high level have an opportunity to speak with each other and to learn from each other, and then to agree on how to scale up some of the learning lessons best practices in some of the areas that we operate in. Two, in my view, it's an opportunity where we enhance humanitarian development agenda and sensitize each other on what that would mean in the different areas that we work. What will be a general principle of humanitarian diplomacy intervention in different places? What does it mean? How do we engage our governments? How much of this relationship can we build? And how can we learn from each other? And who could be used as a resource person or persons to be able to support and build the capacity of others? On the climate summit, this is Heads of State Summit under the African Union auspices. It's a very, very important gathering. In my view, it's a preparatory meeting for the co-op. So the African agenda in the co-op would, in my view, emanate from this meeting that's going to take place in Nairobi. Now, I've taken part in co-ops myself, having been head of a regional organization. I get sometimes a bitter taste in my mouth. Some of the things that we mention, it looks like we're saying, look, we are not the cause of climate change. Therefore, those who are causing climate change then must be responsible for our climate change issues. There may be some truth in that, but that's not all the truth. All the truth is the fact that this is a global phenomenon, it's with us, and we need to solve it globally together as a global community. So some of the issues I mentioned earlier, like the advocating for inclusion, is important, which we need to agree on as a global community. Issues pertaining to the financing and how you access financing, and the proportionality of financing that goes to the highest need area is important. So these are the areas that I think as a continent, we should go prepared to say in the COP.
Today, in your role, with all the bad news around us, what gives you inspiration, hope, comfort? What keeps you going?
What keeps me going really is the fact that I always think of people who are in need. I tell my colleagues, some of my friends that we are talking, some of them who are lucky to have had a much more privileged, including my children. I tell my children, in fact, because they have had much more privileged upbringing than myself. And even at the household level, we think differently. So I encourage my children to give, for example. I tell my children, look, learn to give, learn to forgive, learn to empathize. Now, what you see is happening to people is not their mistakes, not their fault. This is destiny that's placed us in different places. So this is the message I carry to all people, to my friends, even at my level, who may not have had my kind of upbringing, and therefore they may not be as empathetic. So really, I think I'm inspired by the environment. I'm inspired by the fact that as human beings, we are not very kind to each other. And you see it on the streets. You see the streets everywhere in the continent. You see it in our politics. You see it in our development agenda. You see it in in the areas where obviously the people don't care about inclusivity and don't care about equity. And when you think that against the background of how many people it affects and the opportunity it denies people, then you feel nauseated. You feel you cringe. You feel nauseated. You feel very bad, really. So this is the kind of way I think. And I think you're right. A lot of people talk to me and they think I made positive differences in their life by talking to them, by offering them help, and by guiding them, and by giving them the opportunity they deserve, you know, really. So I think this is something that we should say loudly, and we should insist on it, and we should know that a small light that that a small fire that you light can probably make the biggest contribution globally.
This podcast is called People in the Red Vest, which is referring to the Red Cross and Red Crescent vest worn by staff and volunteers. And you're actually wearing one today, but our listeners can't see that. So what does the red vest mean to you?
Well, the red vest means to me, and I explained a bit of it earlier, people who are big-hearted, who want to share, who want to give their time to other people who, for some reason, have realized that livelihood is about contribution of people to, for each other. It may be material support, but it may be support in kindness. So when you put on the red vest and you're running to a nearby accident scene and you are retrieving people who are hurt, that the guts that gets you there, the courage that you have that gets you to attend to a medical situation when you're not even a medic yourself, the fact that you are a volunteer, therefore you're in a scene which is not, you're not there for any, for example, valuable gain other than giving back, which is probably the biggest gain intrinsically if you think about it.
Many thanks, Ambassador Malim. It's been a real pleasure and an honor to speak to you. And I thank you for all the work you do and look forward to seeing you in Nairobi soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to People in the Red Vest, a podcast of inspiring stories as told by people from the IFRC. This podcast was produced by Malcolm Lucard, Damien Naylor, and myself. Promotion and marketing by Maxime Bouchard, Irina Ruano, and Melis Figanmeshe. Graphic design by Valentina Shapiro, and web support from Chris Okwa and Patrick Tai. Additional engineering and editorial support by Anne Wanjiro Macharia. For more inspiring stories, subscribe to wherever you listen to podcasts.